This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, who said it has been a busy 2 years in office. She made a very important announcement. Kim Fox said that the Cook County State's Attorney will begin to pursue the expungement of all misdemeanor marijuana convictions in Cook County. She then launched into a discussion of stopping violent crime. And she said it means confronting iniquity and inequality, social level, educational level, economically, and more. She said this is not a law enforcement issue, but it's an issue that involves everyone. She invited the audience of more than 400 people to visit the Cook County data portal because data determines, she said, where the state's attorney concentrates its efforts. The approach of the office right now is to prioritize violent crime, avoid bringing people in who will never be charged with the crime, transparency, and building trust, owning up to the historical failures of the state's attorney's office over the years. She said that last year, 68 convictions were vacated since she took office. 7 years of data has now been made accessible on all felony cases in Cook County. Age, race, whether charges were approved or denied, the Cook County State's Attorney Office, according to State's Attorney Fox, is the only office in the United States to have done this. Access to information will help hold the State's Attorney's Office and people accountable. It leads to good public policy. For activists, she said, there is now a glass wall around the office. State's Attorney Fox also challenged the county clerk and the chief judge's office to make their data public. She said, we have to shake things up in Cook County. The most prosecuted felony in Cook County in 2018 was unlawful use of weapons, and her staff has increased the conviction rate by 30% in the last 18 months. She is becoming more directly involved with vertical prosecution models in sexual violence, domestic violence cases, and in health issues, drugs, opioids, and much more. The emphasis, she said, will increasingly be not on incarceration, but on diversion in drug conviction cases. The Cook County State's Attorney, it's not the old attorney's office that we remember from many decades ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, Arne Duncan. Mr. Secretary.
Thank you so much, Jay. I'm not speaking. I'm introducing Kim. So this will be mercifully brief, and you get the star of the show in a second. But I'm honored to be here to introduce someone who I respect so much and have so much admiration for. I'm not going to go through Kim's bio. You guys can read that. Probably have it in front of you. I just want to say a couple brief things about what I think about her and how I've gotten to know her as we've worked together over the past couple years. First of all, at a time when, you know, confidence locally, state level, nationally is a little bit shaken in government, where trust is down, we need moral leadership. I think Kim brings that every single day. She's, I think, just an absolute product of Chicago and the things that make us great and the things we struggle with. Kim is very, very honest and forthright, and she's a product of our pain and of loss, and of violence, and of abuse, and all those things have shaped her. But so too have the better things in Chicago: our love, our hope, our resiliency, our work together to reduce that violence and create some peace. She's a prosecutor, we know that, state's attorney. She's, is she tough on crime? Of course she's tough on crime. But I don't think that's her mission in life, is to be tough on crime. I think her mission in life is to help stop crime, to stop it before it happens. I think her goal is to be a champion for safety, a warrior for a more just society, and for building a community where children can grow up free of fear, free of that fear that for her was very, very personal growing up. I won't speak for all of us. I'll speak for myself as we think about leaders today, leaders in public sector, private sector. I don't think we're looking, okay, I'll speak for myself. I'm not looking for perfection. I am looking for a couple of other things. I'm looking for authenticity. I'm looking for an ability to listen. I'm looking for a willingness to take on the toughest questions in an open and honest way. One small anecdote, we had an event a couple months ago. We brought in James Foreman, who wrote a very thought-provoking, provocative book about locking up our own. And we had a dialogue, and Kim got up and asked a really profound question. And at the end of her question, she said, "How can I not be that person who locks up our own?" That's the kind of questions that she struggles with every single day. I said earlier, we need leaders with a clear North Star, a clear set of values. And I think all those attributes, an authenticity, an ability to listen, the ability to challenge herself, to ask the toughest questions, not of others, but of herself, and a clear sense of where she wants to go. I think she brings that every single day, not because it's her job, not because that's what she doesn't like to do, it's because who she is. It's core to who she is. The final thing I'll say, and then we'll welcome Kim, is that I've seen her in fancy ballrooms like this with the affluent and the powerful, and I've seen her in church basements with the less affluent and the less powerful. And who she is and what she says is exactly the same in both settings. And Kim, personally, I appreciate that more than everything else. Please give a warm round of applause to Kim Fox.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Ernie. People ask me whenever I come in here, you know, how's it been? How's it been going? You can look at me. I have gray hair. And I now need readers. It's been a busy 2 years. First, before I begin, I want to take this opportunity to acknowledge my staff, many of whom are here today, who truly are the best and brightest attorneys that we have here in the state of Illinois. They have great attorneys in DuPage County as well, Bob. However, I really wanted to take an opportunity. The work that we do, I am the face of it. It is my name. It is my name in the position, but it is the hundreds of men and women of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office who stand on the front lines of our criminal justice system every day, who don't have the opportunity to be acknowledged for their good work. Oftentimes, the work that we do is some of the grimiest, grittiest, most heartbreaking work that you see. But I am so proud of the men and women that I have the fortune to work alongside of, and I just wanted to have an opportunity for them to stand and be acknowledged. And we don't get good fancy meals often, so I told them to eat, and eat some more. So in the past year since I've addressed the City Club, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office has worked diligently to use our limited prosecutorial resources both strategically and appropriately. First and foremost, to prioritize violent crime. Second, to develop reforms that avoid needlessly bringing people into the justice system, and to build the most open and transparent prosecutor's office in the country. That has been our mission. The foundation of this work is trust. Everything we do revolves around it, and that means admitting when we do things wrong. As we work to restore the public's faith, we must own our historical failures, acknowledge them, apologize for them, and actively work to fix them. We cannot have a criminal justice system that lacks integrity, credibility, and transparency. When I was here last year, I was noting the work of our Conviction Integrity Unit, which is tasked with reviewing the possible cases of wrongful conviction. And when I was here last year, I told you that we'd seen a 500% increase in the cases referred to us under this administration. I am proud to stand before you here today and say that since we've been here, we have vacated 68 convictions since I've taken office. Why does that matter? It matters because some of the convictions that have been vacated were men and women who were living in public housing, who were the victims of a corrupt police officer, a system that had acknowledged that this person had done wrong. But the men and women in his wake, who were vulnerable because of their position in life, were saddled with convictions that were wrongfully gained. For those who had experienced that in their lives, their trust and belief in the justice system that requires us to work with them, that requires them to have faith that the system is working for their good, these were people who had the system turn on them. If we want to address crime and violence in our communities, putting trust foremost and acknowledging when we've got it wrong is paramount. To those men and women who now have the ability to have those convictions vacated, to be able to get gainful employment and opportunity is critical to all of us. But building the most open and transparent prosecutor's office in the country also means showing our work. After hiring our first ever chief data officer, Matthew Saney, we released 7 years of felony criminal data, which provided an unprecedented access into the work of a prosecutor's office. That means that the public now has access to, for the first time ever, all the felony cases that have been presented to the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, which includes the age and the race of the offender, and if we've approved or denied charges. We are the only, I repeat, the only prosecutor's office in the United States to have done this. I firmly believe that our work must be grounded in data and in evidence, and that the public should have access to that information to hold us accountable. So often, particularly when we're talking about criminal justice, the narrative and our policy decisions are driven by anecdote. We are driven by the one story that we heard that made the news, and therefore we must find a fix related to that story. That is not how good policy is made. That is how decades later we try to fix historical failures by not using data and evidence. That is not a way that this office operates. Though recognizing that not everyone is a statistician and may find it difficult to make sense out of raw data, we created a forum to teach our constituents across the county how to use the open data portal. Hacking for Justice is a free 2-day summit where our pro bono technology partners train community members, advocates, and activists to better understand and analyze our data so that we can all be better informed. I think it's important for us to recognize we didn't want this data available just for people who were supporters of the Fox administration. We wanted this data available to the activists who say we are not doing enough. In order for me to be fully held accountable, again, we have to make that information available to everyone and give them the opportunities to access it. And now that that data has been made public, the state's attorney's office has a glass wall around it. And even when the next person occupies my seat, there's no going back to even being remotely opaque. I take this opportunity to encourage my colleagues throughout the court system, which includes the clerk's office and the chief judge's office, to also make their data public as well. This is an opportunity for the entirety of the Cook County criminal justice system to be publicly accessible. We owe it to the people that we serve to be open to scrutiny and for others to examine our work for patterns or biases. It's time that we shake things up in Cook County by creating a new narrative of transparency in our court systems. This commitment to no longer operate in the shadows is our path to restoring faith and rebuilding public trust. But not only do we use our data for transparency, but we also use it to allow us to make better decisions. In 2016, when I first took office, I took office December 1st of 2016. By the end of that year, there were 34 children who were murdered, and more than 300 children who were shot in the city of Chicago alone. But if you looked at the work of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, in 2016, the most prosecuted felony in Cook County wasn't guns, wasn't homicide. It was retail theft. As we work to both improve public safety and repair the fractured relationship between law enforcement and community, prosecuting the small population of people who drive the most violence and winning those cases must be our top priority. We used our prosecutorial discretion to address this data disparity, and we stopped prosecuting felony retail theft for cases less than $1,000. Now, when I was here last year, I told you we took flack for that. When I was here in 2017, we took flack for that. I stand by our decision to pre-prioritize the limited resources that we have at the state's attorney's office. I also must give context to where we stand in the state of Illinois as it relates to felony retail theft. Our neighbors in Indiana, their threshold for retail theft is $750. Our neighbors in Wisconsin, it's $2,000. In Minnesota, it's $1,000. In Missouri, it's $900. When I tell people about this and they say that somehow I've gone off the range, the question becomes, who do we want to be on the range with? The other state that has a retail theft threshold of $300 is Florida. As a result of this change, the most prosecuted felony in 2018 was the unlawful use of a weapon, gun charges. The data also showed that we weren't successfully prosecuting gun cases that were being charged, the data that we were able to glean back from over the years. At a low point, in 2011, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office approved 98% of the cases that were brought to us. So most of the cases that came were approved. But the conviction rate in 2011 was 46%. 46%. What we found by looking at the data and removing ourselves from antidote was that we needed to build better cases that would hold up in court. It didn't matter if we approved 98% of the charges that were brought to us if we were losing more than half of them. To remedy this, we created the Felony Review Guidebook so that our law enforcement partners had a manual of what we needed to make a strong case. We also now meet monthly with CPD to share gun data and addressing reoccurring themes and issues. And Superintendent Johnson has been a tremendous partner with us in that effort. And we've done this without any significant reduction in the number of cases that we accept for prosecution. In fact, in 2018, we've driven up our conviction rate by 30%. And again, for those who want to check our work, go to the Cook County Open Data Portal. And I challenge you, as you have conversations about this, to send others to the Cook County Open Data Portal. Our conviction rate for gun crimes has improved by 30%. In short, we didn't cherry pick the best cases. What we did was we worked diligently with our law enforcement partners, many of whom are here today, to build better cases that would withstand judicial scrutiny. And we didn't just build better cases, we created new units to better address violent crime. After seeing the success of our Gun Crime Strategies Unit, we embedded assistant state's attorneys in CPD districts to work alongside officers and build the best cases. And now we are proud to launch our Violent Crimes Investigations Unit. The Violent Crimes Investigations Unit is a neighborhood-based approach where we use data to identify the communities that need us the most, focusing on long-term investigations that address the small population of individuals that are driving the most violence. In addition, we've made some changes in our sexual assault and domestic violence division as well. There's an element of humanity to the work that we are doing. As I said earlier when I introduced my staff, we meet people at the lowest points in their lives. No place is that more present than in our sexual assault and domestic violence unit. And it means for us that justice means that we recognize the complexity and the frailty of the human condition as we come in contact with it. Nurses, doctors, police officers, social workers, and prosecutors can cause a sexual assault or domestic violence survivor to relive one of their most tragic or traumatic experiences during the reporting process. oftentimes discouraging others from reporting. To lessen this emotional toll, survivors now will only speak to one attorney in our office about their assault. We're moving to a vertical prosecution model to relieve the trauma for victims and survivors who come to our office. Also, in the interest of seeking justice, we've also implemented an additional review for murder cases where the offender has been identified as a sexual assault or domestic abuser survivor. These are important factors when charging the case, and we must do our due diligence considering all of the circumstances. But as we continue to contemplate this notion of justice, it's time to re-examine the criminal justice system's role in addressing public health issues. A new report released last week by the National Safety Council notes that Americans are more likely to die of an accidental opioid overdose than a motor vehicle crash. Here in Cook County alone, the medical examiner's office confirmed that last year at least 1,300 drug-related deaths occurred in Cook County. 1,300. Many of the people who are battling issues with addiction have come in contact with the criminal justice system. A few weeks ago, there was a widely distributed obituary that appeared in the Washington Post of a young mother from Vermont who had passed away at the age of 30. Her family, in their obituary for her, painfully described her addiction that started when she was at the age of 16. They talked about her, and her name was Madeline, being an avid swimmer who loved to ski and to snowboard. They talked about how Madeline had tried over the years to beat her addiction. In fact, her family noted that she tried harder and more relentlessly to stay sober than we have ever seen anybody try after the birth of her son. Unfortunately, Madeline succumbed to her addictions and died at the age of 30. And while this obituary was being widely circulated and there was this talk about the humanity of those who suffer from addiction, I, as the prosecutor here in Cook County, couldn't help but note that she would be treated as a criminal. That the last act before she lost her life was a criminal act, possessing a narcotic. And so while we were able to see the humanity of this young woman in her obituary and the fullness of her life, I was struck with, to the point that Arnie made, the tough questions that we have to ask ourselves as a system and as a society. What do I do with the thousands of Madelines that come through the Cook County court system every day? How do we have these conversations not just about a young woman in Vermont, but a woman from the West Side? How do we not acknowledge the people who are coming in and out of our criminal justice system who are struggling with issues of drug addiction, which is, we know, is a public health crisis? But our only solution has been to ask the criminal justice system to deal with it. Incarceration is not treatment. And I know that this is a room of people who understand that, but I feel compelled to say it again and again. Incarceration is not treatment. And the Cook County State's Attorney's Office will no longer address the public health crisis of drug addiction in our criminal justice system. Diversion will be the presumption in drug possession cases. We cannot criminalize disease. And that also includes those who are struggling with mental illness. I am proud today to announce our Mental Health and Diversion Advisory Committee, a panel of mental health experts and criminal justice officials created to increase our understanding of the intersection between the criminal justice system, mental health, and addiction. Dr. Nika Jones, a clinical psychologist and a leader in residence at Chicago Beyond, who is also the former executive director of the Cook County Jail, is chairing that committee. I also see Dr. Safar, who is here with us today, was a participant in our committee as well. This committee has been tasked with deconstructing some of the longstanding narratives and frameworks around mental health, addiction, and prosecution that are currently perpetuating cycles of incarceration. This is the part everyone's waiting for. In furtherance of our goals to prioritize violent crime and to develop reforms that avoid needlessly bringing people into the criminal justice system, there is no greater opportunity for us to do that than with the prosecution of marijuana. I want to say publicly to all of you that I am in support of the legalization of marijuana. I also believe that as we do this, we must do it acknowledging the public health and the public safety ramifications thereof. I do not believe that we can rush to get legalization done for expediency's sake and certainly not for revenue's sake. I do, however, believe that it is the right mechanism for this county to go and that we should be thoughtful about that. In that belief, here in the state's attorney's office, we have already begun to move away from prosecuting most cases of marijuana possession. But that does very little to help those who can't get a job or who've been denied housing because of a previous marijuana conviction. Failing to take action that provides relief to those who already have a marijuana conviction is not justice. Therefore, I'm announcing to you all today that our next step is to pursue the expungement of all misdemeanor marijuana convictions here. I told you, you're waiting for that. It's like a burden on my heart. And listen, I'm proud of the accomplishments that we have achieved over the last 2 years, and none of it, again, would have been possible without the dedicated attorneys, investigators, administrative staff, and all of you who've been supportive of our work. But I have to say that our role is reactionary. To take a moment to close the book, I'm a prosecutor. I deal with crime after the crime has happened. After the chalk outline has been drawn, after the blood has been washed away, after an arrest has been made, that's when my office comes into play. We are not those who are out there preventing crime, but we have to have an honest conversation about not just our responses to crime, but how we prevent crime from happening in the first place. That requires us to have open and honest conversations about the need for resources and equity and the unfair distribution of those resources throughout our city and our county. It means that we have to be supportive of violence prevention programs like the work that Chicago CRED is doing, engaging those who have been involved in violent crime. It is exceptionally important for us to acknowledge that if we look at case closure rates, if we look at conviction rates, and recognize that people who live in our neighborhoods are living amongst those who have been harmed and are causing harm, and that if they're not in our criminal justice system, that doesn't mean they're still not in our neighborhoods. That means that we have to affirmatively move for organizations to have funding to provide for care and prevention for those who are most impacted by violent crime. We have to acknowledge that the people who end up in our criminal justice system, many of them have been victims of violent crime themselves. That there is a revolving door between victim and offender. And that we cannot open our hearts only when someone has been found to be a victim, and the next day close our minds when we see them on the other side. I will always have a job if that's the case. I will always be in the position of prosecuting violent crime if we aren't serious about stopping violent crime in the first place. And that means difficult conversations around economic opportunity, difficult conversations around education equity, about the absence of mental health facilities in communities most impacted by trauma, about the absence of services for those who are suffering from addiction. The absence of those things lead people to a path that get to me. And as much as people want to blame someone for what's happened into the breakdown in our neighborhoods on law enforcement, this is not a law enforcement issue. This is an all of us issue. And so my challenge to all of you as we leave this place today is to first go to the Cook County Open Data Portal and share with those who insist anecdotally that things have gotten so much worse, they have not. But second, to challenge where you are and how we have the narrative around crime and violence in this city. And to ask ourselves, all the systems that feed into our criminal justice system, what have we done to make sure that they are aimed and geared towards violence prevention? I ask all of you, because that is required of all of us. Again, the men and the women of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office stand ready to prosecute crime, to keep our community safe, to make sure that we do it in a way that reduces harm. But we need all of you to work with us to make sure that we live in a city and a county that's fair and equitable and responsive to all. Thank you very much.
Totally deserves that standing ovation. Someone sent me a message during the speech and said, Kim is a real winner. We are fortunate to have her as a Cook County State's Attorney. And I think that's, I'm a little biased, but.
I think my husband sent that.
He did not. But he did say, send me clips. Okay. So how did you know Kelly and I were texting?
I know you
So I think that that was apropos. We are definitely fortunate to have her sitting in that seat. So with that said, I'll start out with some real soft ones.
Sure.
Not?
Don't.
Okay. So the first question I have is from Char Rivette, who is the executive director of the Chicago Children's Advocacy Center. You know Char well. Char says, woo, yeah, it's a great organization. I'm a little biased there, too. What are your plans towards... helping, what are your plans or thoughts to help intervene in cases of youth with sexually problematic behaviors? How can we increase interventions to reduce risk and future offenses? P.S. We can help.
No. So we're going to enlist Char Rivette to help us. Thank you for your question. Again, as we talk about cycles of violence, what we also know around issues related to sexual abuse, particularly for young people who then begin to exhibit these behaviors, that our response cannot simply be prosecution. We need to recognize and work with our system partners who deal specifically with juvenile sex offense cases or juvenile sexual behavior, which is very different than adults. And I know that for many people, they see someone's been engaging in sexually problematic behavior. There's an assumption that they will not grow out of this behavior. But in the meantime, in between time, we have to have those interventions in place. And so I'm very pleased that we have new thoughts that are in our juvenile justice system. We have a new head of, well, not new, she's been here for 2 years, and Mariam Ahmed, Michelle and Becchiani, who is with us doing juvenile policy on how we can work with system partners to deal with these issues earlier so that, again, the first time we're not dealing with someone who is dealing with sexually problematic behaviors is in a courtroom instead of in the community.
Christine Carrot, are you here, Christine? Okay. She just has a thank you. Thank you for your work and caring. What is your policy? There is a question. What is your policy for teenage under 20 first-time theft, even if it's under $1,000, for other than nonviolent crime? I think you already talked about that.
Yeah, so listen, we also look at cases on a case-by-case basis. I often have to remind people that Cook County is the home of the first juvenile court in the world. And so we recognize for young people, the age of majority in Illinois is 18. And so what we try to do is look at a holistic approach. Are there needs that this young person has that can be best addressed outside of the justice system, which may require diversion? Is this an issue that's more complicated that might require intervention? And so the threshold amount alone is not dispositive of what happens to a case. We have exceptions to those rules if we believe that there is something that requires us to do more. So there's no blanket answer for that. It depends on the individual who has been accused and the circumstances of their case.
This question comes from Dr. Ed Mazur. I think he's a member. He happens to be the city club chair, in case you all didn't know. He says, how does your office decide whether to change an arrestee for a misdemeanor or felony if brought in Markham, 26 in California, rolling metals, et cetera? Is there a standardization of assistant state's attorneys when making the felony or misdemeanor decision?
It's a great question, Dr. Mazur. Most people don't know how cases come to our office. There are two ways which cases come to our office. Misdemeanor cases, so anything that's punishable by less than a year in prison, are direct filed by our law enforcement partners. That means that they will issue whatever they issue, give you a court date. Our office is not involved in the initial charging of misdemeanor cases. Felony cases, things that are punishable by more than 1 year in prison, the state's attorney's office has a 24-hour unit called our felony review unit. That unit is activated when a police officer or law enforcement partner calls up to that unit and says that I have a case that I want to charge for a felony. So in most cases, the decision whether something is going to be a misdemeanor or a felony is decided early on by the law enforcement partner. They have to actively seek for something to be charged as a felony, with the exception of drugs. Drugs is the only felony class that can be direct filed by law enforcement. Everything else has to be reviewed from felony review. What we've done for felony review that I alluded to in our remarks is to try to put some clarity and consistency around how decisions are made. As you pointed out, Dr. Mazur, we have assistants in Markham, all the way to Rolling Meadows and 26 in California. What we didn't want to have was that someone in Markham would be charged with a felony for something that someone in Rolling Meadows would not be charged for. Again, because we weren't looking at data and because we didn't have standardization around how we were looking at these cases, that was very well sometimes the practice. So what we did was worked with our people in our felony review unit and throughout the office to come together on a working group to put together a guidebook that would be for our office as well as for our law enforcement partners throughout the county. So not just CPD, but our suburban departments as well, so that they had an understanding of all the things that we are looking for before we're able to make a charge for a felony. If sometimes we reject the charge as a felony, that case can then still be tried or charged as a misdemeanor. So a felony can get knocked down to a misdemeanor from the state's attorney's office. A misdemeanor can only be charged as a felony when police bring it to the state's attorney's office felony review unit. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
If I was in law school, I'd take your class.
I think the importance of the data collection is hugely significant. I think those of us in corporate America and in the utilities and things like that, I think we all appreciate that very much, Kim. This question comes from Kathy Tate Bradish. Are you here, Kathy? Okay. Make sure you raise your hand because I don't ask questions if you're not here. Okay. Do you have an opinion about the deployment of police? Do you support reallocating from low crime to high crime areas?
I think what we're trying to do, and I think echoes what I think we need to do in crime prevention anyway, is use the resources that are available to the areas that need them the most. I can only speak to our office. You know, we had 4 community justice centers that were spread throughout the county. What we found, and to the chagrin of some, there were some areas that were lacking, that was never going to be enough. And then you saw others that didn't have capacity. And so what we believe is that you have to use data. If we're truly concerned about driving down violence, then you have to put the resources where the issues are occurring. That's just common sense to me. I think the problem is that we haven't been using data to do that. This one-size-fit-all prosecution model or law enforcement model doesn't make sense. The needs are very different in different communities. We talk a lot about the city of Chicago, but we have areas in the south suburbs who had been under-resourced and have significant needs. No, they don't have hundreds of homicides, but for a town that only has 25,000 people, if they've got 4 or 5, that has a real deal deep impact. And so we have to allocate our resources appropriately. I think the way that we do that is by using data and making a tough case. I have taken heat from some who say, why are you moving resources from one part of the city to the other? And again, I have to point to the data that suggests if we want to have a real impact on violence and crime in these neighborhoods, we have to do that reallocation.
I have two more questions. Both are very good questions, actually. Kelly O'Brien. Hi, Kelly. The Alliance for Regional Development, and this, maybe you don't just use this one example, but maybe speak broadly. Sure. Alliance for Regional Development says, what advice can you provide to communities like Orland Park after the recent shooting in its mall? How can we deter violence in those communities?
Yeah, I think the conversations about violence have to, one, we can be ignited by one instance and start to peel back and ask questions of how we got there in the first place. As someone who lives in the South Suburbs, who has teenage daughters who go to the Orland Park Mall, I was shattered to think that someone would engage in such violence. Not that I don't see violence every day, but inside a mall where we think to ourselves, is there sanctuary anywhere? The sad reality is that there is not. I think what we have to do is what I also alluded to in my remarks, is ask ourselves, who is the person who pulled that trigger? What are the things that were red flags in their case? Who is the person who was killed? What are the mechanisms? Because again, the knee-jerk reaction will give us a solution that fits just one part of the problem. And so the conversations in community, the conversations that I'm having with my children is, who is this person? What are the networks that they were a part of? How do we make sure that there are resources there? At the mall, there are questions all the time. What do we do with young people who are accompanied at the mall at different hours? If you have teenagers, you understand the challenges that come with being impulsive and working and roving in groups. And I say that because my kids hang out in groups, and what happens with peer pressure and the things that get them to engage in behaviors that when they're on their own, they wouldn't do. And so I think that's what we have to do. I really think your question speaks to the broader narrative in Chicago that, I don't know if you could tell, frustrates me a little bit, and why I'm so passionate about the work that Arnie and others are doing like him, is we cannot think that the only solution to dealing with tragic incidents like this is in law enforcement. They are a partner. They should work with us. They have information. They have intel. But before that person decides that they should pull a trigger in a mall, there are some things that have failed before we got there. And so as you have those conversations, as you have those conversations in the aftermath, bring everybody to the table. If your only solution to talking about what happened at the mall is to just sit with law enforcement and not sit with others, we're only going to get a piece of the problem. So I would suggest that as you have these conversations, that we broaden out the scope of how did we get there. Again, the person who pulled the trigger is the person who's responsible for that death. Make no mistake. That is that person's, they did that. And they should be held accountable for it. But we also have to make sure that the next person doesn't feel that they can do that as well. And the way that we do that is having a holistic approach to talking about these issues.
That's why the person said to me that we're fortunate to have her as the Cook County State's Attorney. I saw Bill Lowry, Cook County Commissioner, somewhere walk in. Hi, Bill. Jean Cole, are you here?
Hi, Jean.
Okay. This is an interesting question, and it is our last one. Why must we rely on federal investigation and prosecution of local state government and corruption? Can you talk about that a little bit, the collaboration of the...
That's your last question.
It's the last one.
What a timely question, Jean. So there are a couple of things. Largely, I talked exclusively about crime and violence today, but there's a piece of our work that we don't generally talk about is our work as civil attorney for the county. And so as civil attorney, we are the attorney of record for the sheriff's office, for the clerk's office, for the assessor's office, all of those separately elected county officials. We also serve as their city or as their civil attorney. That means if they get sued, we represent them in court. So what you can imagine, particularly when you're talking about corruption cases, say that may involve a county official, our representation, that relationship as their attorney, makes us not the person to do the prosecution. The U.S. Attorney's Office does that. The state's attorney's office does have a public integrity unit that does deal with issues of corruption. A lot of the cases that you may see involve school districts or park districts or other municipalities, agencies who are engaging in some form of corruption. Now, I will also say that our office is largely criminal. The U.S. Attorney's Office has a mandate and the resources to do the long-term investigations that are required for public corruption cases. A lot of the cases that we have, someone will come with a box full of evidence that someone has been skimming funds or resources, and our financial crimes unit can deal with that. But for some of these larger cases, hypothetically, if someone were on a consensual overhear or a wire, that type of work requires a dedicated team and resources and partners, for example, the FBI, to work with the federal agencies to do that kind of work. So we do it, not to the scale that you see the U.S. Attorney's Office do it, largely because that is in their wheelhouse. We do it on a much smaller scale, largely because of the conflicts with the county, and also because our office has been situated mostly to deal with violent crime.
See, it wasn't that hard.
No.
So I want to say this, all joking aside, because Kim deserves to have some fun, too.
Yes.
Well, she did have breakfast with Jay-Z's yesterday, texting, talking about, well, I'm having breakfast with Jay-Z. I was like, I hate your life. I hate your life. But Connie Lindsay tells me this all the time, and it is to cover all the ground that you stand on. And I know Connie's probably told you that before as well. She's here. And it is so true. She has a lot of ground to cover. She stands on all of it, if you know her story. But that is why she is our Cook County State's Attorney. So thank you, Kim.